That's it. This morning I'm going to shift gear a little bit and sort of talk about what I think is sort of one of the biggest challenges of machine learning and as a consequence, probably one of the biggest challenges of computer vision and various other fields that use machine learning. And it's the issue that manifests itself in the problem of invariant recognition. But more generally, it's the problem of sort of learning very complicated functions that are very highly nonlinear. And the fact that the methods that are sort of popular and sort of well understood theoretically actually fall short for this kind of problem. So one interesting question that you have to marvel at is that the human visual system or the visual system of most animals is able to recognize objects independently of their position, size, the particular instance, the illumination, and in our case, even if the object doesn't look anything like previous objects we've seen before in the same category, we're still able to identify them as belonging to that category. So I showed you I'm showing you sort of a bunch of really strange airplanes, which most of you may never have seen before, but you can probably tell right away that they're airplanes or they're supposed to fly. Whether they fly or not is a different story. But it looks like they're designed to fly. And that despite the fact that you've probably rarely seen wing shapes like this. So how is it that with sort of a few training samples, in effect, a few label samples, we're able to kind of classify or generalize to things that are widely different from the original samples? And the sort of traditional view of machine learning is that you have a bunch of training samples that are labeled, you train your machine using those training samples, and then you test it on different samples and you see what the performance is. And there is sort of a general feeling among many people in machine learning that the paradigm of supervised learning is not sufficient to explain things like this. You have to appeal to sort of other principles. One of which is unsupervised learning, surprisingly enough. So this is not only a challenge for computer science or for mathematics, but it's a challenge also for neuroscience. Visual neuroscience is an enormous field, and we know a lot about the details of neurons, about the architecture of the visual cortex, but we have no idea how it actually works, which is kind of a sad thing to say. And so the visual system can obviously do those really amazing recognition. We have a working system under our eyes, actually behind our eyes, as well as in front of it, and we can't tell how it works. So there is sort of a thing that people have come up with in psychology, which is that the recognition of everyday object is an extremely fast process. It looks like really the visual cortex is computing a function very, very quickly. And there is essentially no time, knowing the anatomy of the visual cortex, there is no time for sort of complex reasoning to occur. It's basically sort of a feed-forward process where signals go from the retina to the infrotemporal cortex where sort of objects are encoded or believed to be encoded. And it's essentially feed-forward, at least for recognizing simple objects for sort of everyday tasks, objects for which we have short words. And we know that because, with various sort of psychological experiments. So basically, you would think that it would be within the realm of possibilities to sort of model this process, mathematically or kind of reproduce it on the computer. And we're sort of getting there, but slowly. So one question that you might ask is, is the visual system built by the genome? Is it sort of hardwired by evolution? Or, which is another form of learning, if you will. Or is it learned by every individual? And there's, again, a lot of evidence to show that it's actually learned spontaneously. There's essentially no anatomical difference between the visual cortex and other areas of the cortex. And that probably means that there's some sort of underlying learning algorithm that takes place in the cortex that pretty much takes place everywhere in the cortex and learns whatever is necessary depending on which signal happens to arrive at that location in the brain. So one of the things that some of a small subset of the machine learning community is interested in is not just solving the next problem in computer vision or text mining or web search, but sort of explaining human learning at the same time. So you know, figuring out how the brain works. It's sort of a fairly simple task, right? So, so one question in particular, is there some sort of universal learning algorithm or architecture that the brain uses that we might be able to reproduce? And of course, we don't want to turn into kind of a cargo cult type of strategy where we sort of try to reproduce all the details of how the brain works and sort of hope magically that things are going to work the same. You know, it'd be kind of equivalent to sort of trying to design an airplane that sort of reproduces every feather of the wing of a bird. And, you know, there's no point doing this, which what we're after here is sort of the equivalent of aerodynamics, you know, sort of understanding the principle that underlie complex learning, which obviously the brain seems to be able to do. So, so one question is, you know, how far can we get by training a vision system end-to-end? And that sort of addresses two of the main problems that I think two of the main problems that sort of machine learning is facing at the moment. One is the sort of intractable partition function problem, which I'm not going to talk too much about, but I'm going to allude to when I explain some of the algorithms. And the other one is the deep learning problem. So basically, something like the visual cortex is very highly nonlinear. It's composed of something like 10 layers of neurons, each of which could be seen as, you know, sort of mighty nonlinear. And we have no idea how to train a system like this efficiently, of that type of kind of complexity, because of we just don't have good algorithms. Okay, so let's talk about deep supervised learning first of all. And I'm going to go really quickly on this because it's kind of old work, but it sort of sets the stage for, and I've talked about this many times before, including here, so I don't want to bore people who've been to sort of my previous talks, but one way to approach pattern recognition, which is sort of the way almost every pattern recognition system is built, is the following. You start with sort of a raw input, you sort of build some sort of pre-processing feature extraction that turns the input into some more palatable representation, and then you plug your latest, greatest learning algorithm on top of it to the classification, which you train in a supervised way. And the problem, of course, is that you have to build this by hand, and you have to build it differently for every new problem, and that's kind of a bad way of going about things. So, so one question is, you know, can we do this? Can we sort of include the entire system into into a big kind of learning architecture that will sort of simultaneously learn not just the classifier but also the feature extractor simultaneously? And it's very difficult to do this in a supervised way. But there are sort of really kind of restricted cases that where it works. So one particular such architecture is the convolutional net, which I'm not going to go into the details of. I'm sort of going to show pretty pictures of it, but that's going to be the end, pretty much the end of it. So it's an old idea that goes back to the 70s, which I've been working on for a long time, and there's sort of a few people in the last few years who've sort of been building upon the idea. Tony Poggio at MIT, Shimon Ullman in Israel, David Lowe at UBC. And it sort of goes by various names, convolutional nets, neocognitron, HMAX architecture. It's based on sort of signal processing, essentially. So, you could view this as kind of a giant neural network that whose architecture is sort of very loosely inspired by biology. A lot of those people are interested in sort of human vision. Fukushima certainly was. Poggio certainly is as well. And the idea is sort of to sort of get inspiration from the visual cortex to kind of build this architecture. So. One thing we know about the visual cortex is that every neuron in the early areas of the visual cortex are connected to kind of a small area of the retina or a small area of the visual field in such a way that they kind of compute a feature at a local small radius in the receptive field. So that's the way we build that system as well. So you can see this as kind of the first layer. And each of those maps you can see as sort of the result of applying a convolution kernel to this input and then passing the result through some sort of saturation function. And so each of those layers, each of those maps extracts kind of a elementary feature everywhere on the input field. And you have multiple types of filters that are applied here. And those filters have long coefficients, okay? The result of the coefficients of those filters are trained as part of the supervised learning process. And then after that, you go through kind of a step of pooling in a way. So take a little neighborhood here and put them together by computing a max or an average. And you get sort of a combined feature that tells you whether a particular feature appears within a certain area of the visual field. Biologists call this the complex cells. This comes from sort of some classic work in visual neuroscience for the 60s, Nobel Prize winning. Hugel and Wiesel, 1962. And you can sort of repeat that process multiple times to kind of extract higher and higher level features until kind of the last layer are sort of global features. Each of those pixels is essentially influenced by the entire input field, and so it can be used to recognize the entire thing. And you can view this as sort of a high-level feature vector that you can feed to a classifier. Okay. But what we're going to do is train the classifier on top, which is a simple linear classifier, together with this entire system altogether using gradient descent. Okay. So the overall architecture looks kind of like this. I'm not going to go through the details, but it's got multiple layers, and because of the constraints that those are sort of convolutional filters. The learning algorithms that we use for this to compute the gradient, which is the backpropagation learning algorithm for neural nets, happens to work pretty well due to the constraint of the architecture. It wouldn't work for kind of a generic type of architecture, but for this particular one, it works pretty well. So you apply this to Hamilton digits, and a lot of people have tried lots of different methods, and that's basically the method that works the best on that data set if you start from raw pixels. Of course, there are methods that use hand-built features that actually work slightly better on this, but they don't really translate to kind of other situation. You can use this to do face detection, to do object recognition of various kinds. Actually, let me show you that. I can't resist just showing those demos.
So did you say you're the best on the handwriting test?
Yeah, if you use the raw pixels. Okay, so. From raw pixels. So if you plug your learning algorithm on raw pixels and train it, this is the best method there is. Okay. It's about, on the NIST data set, without any tricks, it's about 0.6% error. If you sort of augment the training set with sort of distortion, you get down to about 0.4, a little less than 0.4% error. There are a few people who get less than that, but on sort of other versions of the data set, and so it's kind of hard to compare. And using sort of features that are built by hand. So, right, so you can train a system like this to kind of spot faces and images and sort of apply it to, you can look at people who are not sort of busy looking at their, actually if I
wake up and
smile, you're on camera.
That's okay. Cool.
Yeah, this doesn't quite work, does it? Okay, here we go. There's not much light, is there? Because it's got a minimum size of faces that it can recognize, so people are too far, it's not gonna get it. Okay, so it's real time. Basically, it's applying this convolutional net to the entire image and sort of spotting areas where it fires.
If you compare it to Viola Jones,
so it's better, faster than Viola Jones in various ways. Actually, I got some numbers. So this is so Viola Jones is sort of the method du jour for doing face detection, and so our system can do a tilted profile and frontal view in one single system. Whereas Viola Jones needs sort of several different systems that are trained with different data sets for each of those views. And our system works as well as Viola Jones at each individual sub Viola Jones, if you want. Okay, but it's a single system. And it does pose estimation at the same time, which I didn't explain how, but it's okay. So it's pretty much as good as it gets. It's really fast. Okay, so we can apply the same kind of method to other problems, like, say, 3D object recognition. So here we have a collection of objects, 25 objects from five categories, animals, humans, planes, trucks, and cars. We're going to use those 25 objects as training samples and the other ones as test samples. Okay, so it's going to be different instances in the test set than in the training set. And for each of those objects, we have views under multiple viewpoints, multiple illuminations, and we're going to slap them onto different backgrounds. So the training set looks either like this for kind of the easy version or kind of like that for the hard version. So the reason I want to show you this is the following. So if you use a linear classifier, so the easy version, the images that are on kind of a uniform background, if you apply just a linear classifier on the raw pixels, you get something like 30% error on the test set. If you apply k-nearest neighbor, it's more like 18% error. Super vector machine is around 13, 11, 12%. And this convolutional net, which is a lot faster than that, is 5.8%. And here is the funny thing. These are numbers that indicate the error rate at various stages of learning and the time it would take in number of minutes on a 1 gigahertz computer. Okay. And this is going to be a sobering fact for those of us who are interested in sort of mathematics. And so a super vector machine is something that's very well understood mathematically. There's all kinds of theorems, bounds of generalization error. The loss function is convex, so there is some sort of assurance that whatever we minimize, we're going to get the global minimum of that loss function. And we only get about 11% error on the test set, and it takes us 480 minutes gigahertz to get there. And the time it takes to recognize an image after the system has trained is about a second. Okay, this is convolutional net on exactly the same data. So to get to the same error rate as the SVM, you have to train for about 64 minutes. And if you keep training for the same time as the SVM, you get down to about half the error. And then it doesn't improve anymore. Okay? And the recognition time is much faster, 30 times faster. Okay, so here is the bad news for mathematics, right? This is not very well understood theoretically. The loss function is very highly non-convex. The function that it computes is very highly nonlinear. The architecture can seem a little ad hoc, right? So it's vaguely inspired by biology. And this one has theorems about it, generalization theorems, representation theorems. The loss function is convex, so we're pretty sure that convergence can be fast. And it takes time slower to train. It's twice the error rate, and 30 times slower to test. It just simply doesn't work as well. Okay, so this is an indication that you really got to be careful about sort of trusting results too much, because it's not because you prove that something works that something else doesn't. It's not because you haven't proved that something works that it doesn't. I would say so. Maybe sort of that shows my background as an engineer more than a mathematician, but that's a kind of a really important thing to remember. And so I would be really interested in knowing, why is this that we can't get results, theoretical results or guarantees about this system, but yet it beats the pants off of the supervector machines. Okay, and it gets worse. So if you do this on the more complex data set, which has more training samples, more complex backgrounds, distractor objects and everything, then the SVM just completely fails. It gets 43% error on the test set after running for weeks. And the SVM is more on the sort of 7 or 8% range. And so, again, the same kind of chart here. I mean, the difference is even more striking. So now it's a difference of 50 or more. And, the training time, this guy sort of crunches for a long time and doesn't get anything to you. And, this guy is sort of a fraction of the time or is already a third of the error. So, there's a bit of knowledge built into the system that this guy doesn't have about the task. But it's a very, very, very little knowledge. So, I think it's really kind of important.
Can you explain what the last column is?
The last column. So, okay, so the last column is an interesting thing. You train the convolutional net, and then you chop off the last layer and use the features produced by the last layer as the input of a supervector machine, which is now a small supervector machine. And that actually improves slightly over the pure convolutional net. So basically, you'll replace the linear classifier on the top of the convolutional net by a Gaussian supervector machine. You get slightly better results.
So did you find any example where the SVM outperformed on this convolutional network?
Yeah, I mean, there are applications where it does. So particularly if you have, not for images, mostly not for images, but unless you feed it with features that are already kind of refined and happen to be appropriate for that problem. Yeah, there's a lot of domains where SVMs just are the best method, like, you know, text classification, for example. Neural nets are really not good for that.
Do you use pixels for input pictures?
Say again?
Do you use pixels?
Yeah, raw pixels.
All raw pixels?
Yes.
So you can't expect it too much, right?
Well, but it works well with this one. So, I mean, you know, the thing is, so the usual trick, of course, is you kind of design pre-processing or kernel that would sort of do a better job, okay? But then it's kind of cheating because this guy works from raw pixels. So, you know, if you're going to work from raw pixels and sort of, you know, not let yourself sort of solve the problem by hand beforehand, which is what you want to be able to do if you want to solve lots and lots of problems without having to think about it too much, then you have to believe.
When you talk about, I don't know it's about computational learning and stuff, but I mean, does it provide kind of unique architecture for these neural nets? I mean, could it?
No, there's lots of parameters you can
right,
change.
So, I mean,
you know,
so
this is a particular implementation of it. But
right, so I mean, it depends on particular implementation. If I implement in a different way, a different number of layers, you know,
yeah,
then I might get worse results, right?
Yeah, worse or better. You know, it's, you know, as you make them bigger, usually they get
better. The parameters.
Say again?
How do you choose the parameters?
Usually through validation. So you sort of set aside a little piece of the training set, and then you kind of set the size of the network. You adjust it.
So these were cross-validated? Or that was?
Well, the size of the network was determined by validation, and then was applied, then was trained on the full training set, and then applied to the test set. Okay.
So all the parameters were chosen by cross-validation, not based on?
Yeah. It's actually not cross-validation, it's just validation. So we use just one validation set. So we don't, you know, do the, because it's pretty expensive to train. Same here for the SVM. For the SVM, we actually cheated. We actually chose the, no, actually, no, that was not cheating. The parameters were also adjusted using validation. Okay, so what's wrong with supervisor machines, or k-nearest neighbor, or kind of things like this? Basically, they're shallow methods. They are sort of glorified template matching, if you want. Okay? So if you think about what a supervector machine is, a supervector machine takes an input vector, it compares it with all or a subset of the training set, the training samples, say Gaussian supervector machine. Okay? So it computes e to the minus the square distance between Euclidean distance between the input vector and all the training samples, or a subset of them. And then you take those scores. Okay, those sort of Gaussian bump scores, and here, and compute a linear combination of them, and then you do the score for one class, and then you do this for all the classes. Okay.
So just to be very certain on the third bullet, is it now a way or no way?
Oh, I'm sorry. No way.
No way.
Lose the W here. Oh, that's an interesting error. yeah. So you know, basically, there is no way in this architecture to learn invariant representation. It's just not built for that. It's a template matcher. So if you want to be able to recognize the airplane in this position and the airplane in that position, you need two templates for the two positions. Mm-hmm. And if you want to recognize it a slightly shifted version, a slightly scaled version, a version with a different background, pixels that are completely irrelevant, they're going to be taken into the template matcher as meaningful pixels. There's no way to drop them on the floor. There's no mechanism in SVM to do this. So it's basically glorified template matching. And you just can't expect that to work very well. And you know, despite all the mathematical reproducing kernel number space arguments you will ever have, it's just not gonna cut it.
I just have a comment. How about if you have other representation, just like you did earlier, you can use those invariant representations to feed into parallel SVMs, for instance.
True.
And they can do as good.
Okay, but then that's just kind of sweeping the dust under the rug. How are you going to come up with that representation? So either you're going to come up with it by hand, or you're going to have to learn it somehow. Okay. So that's actually an interesting question, which I didn't talk about. Okay, so. So we're not going to learn invariants with SVM. That's just out of the question. So, you know, We know, of course, the visual cortex is not an SVM, but one reason it's not is because there is no heterogeneous invariance. Yeah, just for the hell of it, let me just show you. Okay. So, all right. So this system, you know, trained on five instances of each of the categories, and it's been trained on airplanes, humans, cars, and trucks. And let me put this GI Joe guy here. It's really overexposed.
You didn't have any trouble on the plane.
Yeah, they really didn't have any trouble. And I don't know what else I can show you. Yeah, that's this little. Twice older guy. Okay, that's a human as well. It's seeing an animal in the back which doesn't exist with a low score. Okay. So anyway, I hope you're convinced. And you know, this guy also. So it's not very good at sort of. It's not sure if it's a human or an animal.
What's the
human?
Wait a minute, a real human.
Yeah. Well, the problem is, it's been trying to kind of see object like, you know, from like 30 degrees to 70 degrees or so, 25 degrees, 30 degrees. So if I were on the third floor of a building and looking down at real people, it would. Figured out, but not in the room. So it's not a detector, so it's going to fire, you know, all kinds of. It's going to want to recognize one of the side categories if I point it at sort of other objects, right? It's trained as a classifier, not as a detector. But it can eliminate the texture of the carpet here and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's real time. It's the only. It's pretty much the only sort of real time 3D object recognition system that is invariant to lighting and position. That can do sort of generic object categories. Okay, so all of this is good, but there's a problem with this, which is that there's a problem with this approach, which is that, you know, we need thousands and thousands of examples of if not different object instances, at least different views. To be able to train those systems, you know, this convolutional net has several hundred thousand parameters in it. So it needs, you know, tens of thousands of training samples. So you would think that to learn vision, you don't really need labeled samples because low-level features tend to be non-test specific. So we should be able to learn that unsupervised, hopefully. And so now I'm going to kind of talk about sort of a new approach, which is used to sort of pre-train architectures of the kind that I showed, and the overall sort of approach to this is called sort of deep belief networks, and this was sort of advocated by Jeff Hinton and one of his students, Russ Shakutinov, in sort of various papers over the last 3 or 4 years. There's an interesting one in Science, financial paper last year. So basically, the idea is how to use unsupervised learning to kind of reduce the amount of necessary training samples that we need. This is not for the talk. This is more if you want to look at the slides later and sort of get some idea of papers here. So let me talk about unsupervised learning. So what is unsupervised learning? So unsupervised learning is, if you are a probabilist, what you want to do is you have a space of objects, vectors, let's say, and you want to compute a probability distribution over that space in such a way that you want to kind of estimate the distribution of objects you observe in the world. Okay, so you point a camera at the world or various objects, and you want to the system to come up with a function that is you know, gives you a large value for things that look like the training samples and low value everywhere else. Okay, that's the density. Now, of course, you know, it's kind of a nil post problem because you only have a discrete number of samples of this, and that distribution might be continuous. So, you know, from the mathematical point of view, it's kind of nil post. You have to come up with, you know, some prior knowledge about, you know, the set of family of distributions you might want to estimate. So that's kind of the probabilistic view. There is kind of a non-probabilistic view of this, which is to say, instead of estimating a probability, we're going to estimate an energy function. So you could view this as kind of a negative log probability if you want. Okay. So basically, a function that's going to take low values where there is lots of data points and high values everywhere else. Right. And so let's say, for example, let's imagine for a second that we had such a function implemented in the computer that gives you a low output value. So it's a function, you give it an image, a 10 megapixel image, let's say, okay? And it gives you a single number. If the image looks like a natural image, it gives you a low number. If it looks like a noisy image or a bad image or a natural image, it gives you a large number, okay? Let's imagine you had a function like this, that you could compute it efficiently on your computer. You could do all kinds of stuff with this. You could do image compression, you could do image denoising, you could do inpainting, you could do, could probably use it for recognition as a help for recognition for feature extraction. So for example, how would you use this for denoising? Well, you plug a noisy image, and then you perhaps do gradient descent in that energy space. So this would be a very high dimensional space with as many dimensions as you have pixels, and you would perhaps do gradient descent and find the closest image to the one you give that happens to have low energy, and that would be sort of a cleaned up version of this noisy image. Okay. So that'd be great if we had a function like this. But of course, estimating functions like this, a very high dimensional surface, is essentially intractable. I mean, we don't know how to do this. Okay. So we can sort of seamlessly go from one to the other. If we have a probability, we can turn it into an energy always. Except if it's zero. But we can't really do it the other way around. So there are energy functions that we cannot really turn into probability distributions because perhaps this integral does not converge. Okay. So it's not like there is a total equivalence between those two. This is kind of a slightly more restricted domain. So we're gonna work with this, all right? Trying to find an energy function gives you low values for things that look like training samples and high value for everything else. So if we are in the probabilistic framework, we're going to say maximize the likelihood of the data under the model, okay? And sort of turn this into a loss function and minimize that loss function. So we have a training set which consists in a series of vectors, y1 to yp. And the loss function is going to be the average over all training samples of the energy that our model gives to each training sample, okay? And this is the log of the denominator of the probability, right? So this is the probability of a single training sample. We compute the product of this. When we take the log, we get a sum. And when we take the log, you know, we get the difference between those two terms, right? And so that loss function basically is that difference between those two terms averaged over the training set. So this is essentially the negative log of the probability that our model gives to all the training samples, okay? Assuming independence of the samples. Right, so here's the problem. We can't compute this guy, because this is the integral of all possible values of y. So if y is the space of all images, there's no way we can integrate that e to the minus beta, the energy function. Beta is a kind of arbitrary positive parameter. There's no way we can compute this integral. So if we're gonna learn this energy function using gradient descent, what we're gonna do is basically do gradient descent in W space over for this function. So we're going to have to compute the gradient of this function with respect to W. And we can just write this down. It's going to be the average of energy of each of the data samples differentiated with respect to the parameter. And then we need the derivative of this term, which is the integral over all possible images, all the whole space, of the probability that our model gives to that particular y, times the derivative of the energy with respect to the parameters at that location. And again, there's no way we can compute this for a high dimensional space. Well, I shouldn't say there's no way we can compute this. If we design E in such a way that it's very simple, then perhaps its integral becomes very simple. So for example, if E is a quadratic function of W, then this becomes just a Gaussian integral, and we can actually compute it. But you know, we know that the world of the space of natural images is not Gaussian. So we can't really do this. And in fact, all the energy functions that people have come up with end up with sort of intractable terms like this. Okay, so the bad news is there's no way we can do maximum likelihood learning exactly. So we're going to have to cut some corners. So one corner we can cut is say, well, you know, I really don't care about minimizing this particular loss function. The only thing I want is the energy near the training samples to be low and the energy everywhere else to be large. Okay? So somehow, push down the energy around training sample and push up the energy everywhere else. Now the question becomes, how do we make the energy everywhere else large? So I sort of talked about this, which is kind of a cop-out. There's a second option, which is to approximate the derivative of the contrastive term in the loss with kind of a variational approximation or something like that. And this is a very active subfield in machine learning. There's a lot of people working on this kind of stuff. And there's a third approximation, which is to do sampling. So you pull down the energy of the training samples, and you pull up on the energy of other configurations that have a low energy that are threatening, essentially. But not all of them, just a subset of them. Okay. So basically, it's the idea that we're going to approximate this integral by a small number of terms, by a sum over a small number of terms. And the question is, how do we choose those terms? Okay, so how do we choose the y's that we're going to sum up to kind of approximate this horrendous sum, this horrendous integral? So one idea is, came from Jeff Hinton, and it's the idea of contrastive divergence, the contrastive divergence algorithm. So what's the idea of contrastive divergence? There's a very simple recipe. The recipe is as follows. So the recipe is to generate bad configurations. So configurations of, so values of y that whose energy you're going to pull up, all right? So you have a training sample, y. You measure the energy of it, and then you run a little dynamical system where, to obtain a bad configuration, you go down on the energy surface with some noise. So basically, you start from the y at the training sample, and you kind of follow, you don't really follow the gradient, but because we're going to add noise to that using, say, Langevin dynamics or perhaps something similar to that. Or hybrid Monte Carlo method. So we're going to go down in the energy, and what that's going to give us is another point in the energy surface that has lower energy, or is likely to have lower energy than where we started from, okay? So that's a bad guy, because it's got lower energy than the point we started from, and the point we started from is a data point. So this should have lower energy than everything else, right? So now we have two points, we're going to push down on this guy, push up on that guy, okay? And if we sample those bad guys with the right probability distribution, then it's actually, you can show that it's an approximation of, kind of a local approximation of the gradient of the likelihood function that I showed earlier. So the effect of this is that the training samples now are going to become a local minimum of the energy surface, okay? Because locally we're going to pull up points along the energy surface to make it a local minimum. And the bad news, the reason it's not exactly maximum likelihood is that we're not going to pull up the energy of all the points that are very far away. Okay? So we basically only care about the shape of the energy surface around the training samples. So that's contrastive divergence. So the way it's actually done usually is using a Monte Carlo sampling method. Basically, it consists in sort of simulating a ball rolling down the energy surface. And initially, you kick the ball in a random direction, and so you get kind of a randomized sample around the training samples. Those things that you got to pull up the energy of. Okay, so now we're going to apply this to a particular set of architectures to kind of use it for extracting features and doing it to vision and things like that, and sort of extract invariant representations. So there is a particular type of architecture called the encoder-decoder architecture, which is particularly interesting. So the encoder-decoder architecture is defined as follows. The energy function as a function of the input vector and the parameter is actually the minimum over some hidden variable of another energy function that has this hidden variable as an argument. Okay. So you could view Z as kind of a code that represents Y. Okay. So if you plug a Y, you run this minimization, you get a Z vector, and that Z vector you can view as kind of a code that represents Y. And the reason, so unfortunately the picture doesn't show for some reason. So let me do this. Okay. Okay, so the architecture is like this. We're going to take the input vector, run it through some encoding function, okay? And then we're going to take the difference between the output of this encoding function and the code vector, which we don't know the value of yet, okay? And that's going to give us one term in the energy function. And the other term in the energy function is a reconstruction error. So we're going to start from the code, run it through a decoder, which is supposed to produce a reconstruction of the input, and then measure the discrepancy between the original input and that reconstruction, and that's the second term in our energy function. Okay, so the overall energy function is sum of two terms. One is the reconstruction error, the other one is some sort of prediction, code prediction error. And you could view a lot of unsupervised learning algorithms as some sort of special case of this architecture, in which the decoder and the encoder perhaps are linear, perhaps this coefficient is essentially infinite or zero, and perhaps there's another term on top of it that sort of imposes sparsity. So for example, compressed sensing would be a situation where you don't have an encoder or all this part of the loss function. You basically just have the decoder and reconstruction error, and there is an additional cost here on the code that which is kind of an L1 penalty. Okay, so linear decoder, squared reconstruction error, and another term here which is an L1 penalty. Similarly, principal component analysis can be viewed as a situation where the encoder and the decoder are both linear. K-means can be viewed also as a version of this, but I'm not going to go into that. Encoder neural nets and sparse over complete representation of the type that Bruno also has in the Brack-Plumer. So Brack-Plumer's version actually is very much like the compressed sensing type system. But let me talk about the model that Hinton is sort of advocating, that's called the restricted Boltzmann machine. So the restricted Boltzmann machine is kind of like a spin-glass-like model, for those of you who know a bit about this. So the energy function also depends on the code and the input and some parameter vector. And it's a sum over a bunch of, sum over input dimensions, sum over code dimensions of minus yi, wij, zj, where the wij matrix is symmetric. Okay? So this is just like a spin-glass or Hopfield nets or Boltzmann machines. So this is why it's called a restricted Boltzmann machine, because that's basically the Boltzmann machine energy. And so the actual energy we use is obtained by marginalizing over Z. And so you marginalize over, so this is the log of a probability, so you take the exponential of this, marginalize over it, you get a sum, and then to get back into energy space, you have to take a log, right? So the overall energy where Z has been marginalized over is something like this. Minus 1 over beta, which is an arbitrary quantity parameter, log of sum over all configurations of Z, exponential minus beta E of YZ, W, where E is defined this way. Okay? This is called a free energy. So the restricted Boltzmann machine is a situation where Z is constrained to be a binary stochastic vector, the distribution on Z can be approximated by sampling. So basically, we sample from the distribution over Z given Y the following way. If you kind of do the calculation correctly, you get that the conditional probability of ZJ, the DJ equal 1 given YW, is some logistic function of the weighted sum of the input variables through the that particular line of the weight matrix, the Jth line of the weight matrix. Okay. So it's kind of like a neural net, right? You compute a weighted sum of the inputs, you get a value here, and then you sample a binary value out of Z with a probability equal to a sigmoid function of this weighted sum. Okay, this is a logistic sigmoid function that goes from 0 to 1 with a threshold of 1. Similarly, if you know the Zs, the conditional probability of each y is very easy to compute. So the nice thing about this is that because the z's are not connected to each other, and the y's are not connected to each other, it's very simple to compute the probability over y given the probability of a z, given the configuration of z, and vice versa. Okay? And both of them involve weighted sums and sigmoids, which is kind of neural net-like type things. So it's very simple to sample from those distributions. So here's the learning procedure. Clamp y to an observed data vector. Sample z from p of z given yw with the formula I said earlier. So that consists in computing weighted sums, passing through sigmoid, and sampling binary values according to the probability given by those sigmoids. And then we're going to sample y bar. So y bar is kind of a new version of y, if you want. It's the one that we would observe by sort of running the system backwards here, by reconstructing from z. Okay. So y bar is like a reconstruction of y from the z that we obtained at the previous step. Okay. And we run that stochastically again using the conditional distribution that I was talking about earlier. And then we sample z bar again from p. Okay. So we have another z bar. And we can now interpret y bar and z bar as one of those bad states of contrasted divergence. Okay, so the purpose of doing this is to basically go down in the energy surface using a sort of Monte Carlo type method. So you can show this is a Gibbs sampling Monte Carlo method. If you don't know what that means, it doesn't matter. But basically what it does is that it sort of probabilistically goes down in the energy surface starting from the data sample. And it gives you a combination of z and y that has moved you away from the original y in such a way that the energy is likely to be slightly lower than the one you started with. Okay? So what are you going to do now? You're going to pull down on the energy given, you know, the energy you get with the y and z, and pull up on the energy you get with y bar and z bar. And the result of doing this is going to be that y and z is going to become kind of a local minimum of the energy surface. So it's going to become stable, basically. Because the next time you're going to run this again, the y bar z bar is basically going to stay at y and z. So that's the learning algorithm. One particular wij is replaced by its value at the previous time step, plus a step size times the product of yi and zj minus the product of yi bar zj bar. Okay. So this is the values you started from, and this is the values you obtain after running this little one-step Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm. And this has the effect, and this is simply the derivative of this loss function, which is the energy of yizi, this should be a y here, so this little term here is a derivative of that term. It's actually minus the derivative of that term. So it's a derivative of the energy of the correct answer minus the derivative of the energy of the of this bad guy that was generated by going down the energy surface, and you want to move up the energy of that guy. And just run this algorithm. And you can view this as kind of a sample approximation of minimizing the negative of likelihood of the data under the model. Okay, so here is the amazing thing. So you train this on, say, handwritten digits, okay? So what you do is you build a system like this, where the input is all the pixels of an image, of a digit, and Z has 200 dimensions, let's say, okay? And you train the thing, and then what I'm displaying here are the value of the weights, okay? So they are the wijs. So each pixel in each of those, squares is one line in the wij matrix, okay? So with all the weights that link all the pixels to one component of z, and each pixel in there is one wij. And so each of these guys essentially detects an elementary feature of the digit. And you see they kind of do something funny. So some of them are sort of global wishy-washy type edge detectors, okay, kind of funnily shaped, you know, badly shaped Gabor functions. And some of them are sort of loop detectors or hole detectors or edge detectors or kind of activation detectors. So the black indicates a negative weight and gray is sort of zero and white is sort of positive, or the other way around, actually. Okay? Now, here's the interesting thing. I'm not sure I can show this, but I'm not sure. try to. I don't know if this is going to work because I don't have a network connection here and this is sort of online, but let's see if this works. Yeah, cool. Okay, so this is actually a multi-layer version of this, but I sort of wanted to show this to you. So this is multiple levels of this restricted Boltzmann machine that have been stacked on top of each other and trained sequentially. So you train the first layer first, and then once it's trained, you stack a second layer on top, and you train the second layer with the output of the first layer, okay? Same way. And then you stack another one on top of it and train it again with the output of the first layer again. And what this is doing is basically sampling from the distribution. So these are sort of confabulation that are produced by this network. And this is by running this sort of Gibbs sampling. And so each of the samples that are generated here basically has a high probability under the model. Okay. And here there is kind of an additional trick here that makes the system, one of the inputs of the system is kind of a category for the digit. So here the unit for 8 is clamped, so the system is kind of confabulating 8s only. Sometimes they look like 9s, but they're kind of chopped up 8. And so it generates a lot of different 8s of various shapes and forms spontaneously by just sampling from this distribution. And there's no way you can do this with a linear system, absolutely no way. I mean, you would need a huge number of templates. So let's see, I'm not sure, I'm gonna try to generate another set, but it might require a network connection for that. No, it works too. Okay, so these are generating 6s now. Okay, so you can use this for recognition. So basically the input to the system now is not only just the input image, but also the category of that image. And both of them are basically two fields of the input, if you will. So you can use this for recognition. So I can click on one of those guys, and it's not gonna work because it wants to connect to the network, so forget about that. Okay, so one idea, another idea for training such encoder-decoder systems, the idea I just mentioned is the idea of basically making sure that the energy of training samples is low under the model, and the energy of everything else is high. And we've done this by explicitly pulling up on the energy of nearby points to the training samples. But there's another way of doing it, and the other way, and that's probably gonna please some of the people who are interested in compressed sensing. The other way of doing this is to basically sparsify the code. So here's the idea. If you run the input to an encoder and you put a constraint on the code to make sure it's sparse, so basically only a few components can be non-zero at any one time, okay? And then reconstruct from this. Then what you're doing by forcing the code to be sparse is that you're telling, you're basically limiting the amount of different code configurations that are allowed here. You're kind of limiting the extent of the space that can be covered by all possible codes. And the good news is that by doing this, it has the automatic side effect of making the reconstruction energy of a lot of things high, automatically. Okay, so sparsifying the code has the same effect of pushing up on the energy of bad guys. And that's kind of somewhat unexpected. So that sort of suggests learning algorithms, unsupervised learning algorithms that are really cool for this, where you run through an encoder, which could be linear or nonlinear, with perhaps nonlinearity. You have an additional term in the energy function that makes sure the code is sparse, perhaps L1, perhaps something else. We use actually a log student T for most of our experiments. Then you run through a decoder and measure the energy as the reconstruction error plus this sparsity term. And you train the encoder and decoder simultaneously to minimize the average energy over the training sample. Okay? So it looks something like this. Run through an encoder. Here it's not a cost function, it's a kind of a nonlinear transform that specifies the code vector. Run through the decoder, decoder measures the reconstruction error. And you apply this to natural images, and the filters you get, so the rows of the encoder matrix, look like kind of edge detectors, Gibbs filters, you know, little edge detectors, little strobe detectors, which is kind of nice. If you apply this to Hamilton digits, what you get are detectors for parts of digits. So basically, what it tells you is that I want to be able, the decoder has to be able to reconstruct the digit from a small number of non-zero code coefficients multiplied by the decoding matrix, right? And so it has to be able to represent every digit by a linear combination of a small number of basis functions, essentially. And so the natural solution to this is that each basis function is kind of a little piece of stroke, because then you can represent any characters by kind of a linear combination of strokes. So that's what it comes up with. So basically, you can reconstruct this 7 as that kind of noisy 7 as a sum of, you know, 9 non-zero coefficient multiplied by those basis functions that have been learned, plus a whole bunch of other terms that are almost all nearly zero. And so we use this to train the filters of a convolutional net, and we get really good results on NES, but I'm not going to go through this because I don't have time. And so Hinton and Shalakutdinov applied this method again. So this is the same people as the NCA paper. But they applied it to kind of other types of application, and they used this sort of stacked restricted Boson machine idea to extract very low-dimensional codes for very highly nonlinear low-dimensional codes for images and data of various kinds. And here are a few examples. So this is how well, so these are a bunch of original digits, I believe. These are digits that are reconstructed by PCA using 30 dimensions. And this is how they are reconstructed using that method, the deep belief network method, stacked restricted Boson machines. I don't remember what this is. Same thing for faces, okay? PCA, mostly PCA, and this deep belief net training. This is slightly more interesting. So this is NIST again, so this handwritten digit data set. And this is two-dimensional codes you get using a principal component. And this is what you get, so using two code units, using this deep belief net with, I believe, 5 layers. Okay, so the classes are really well separated. And the nice thing is that there is no information given to the system as to the category of the characters. Okay, so it's completely unsupervised. And the thing sort of separates spontaneously all the categories. So the system I showed you, I demonstrated with the little animation, it's this one. Actually, it's not this one. It's this one that's been further trained with labels. This is more interesting. This is applied to text. So this is a text from the, I believe, the Wall Street Journal or Reuters dataset, I think. PCA gives you a big mess. And these are the various categories that can spontaneously emerge from applying this algorithm. You know, government borrowing, accounts, energy market, interbank. And Jeff Hinton, who is British, makes a joke that European community comes right next to disasters and accidents. But he's British. As a Frenchman, I take that personally. What's happening? I'm going to skip for reasons of time, but we have a way of sort of training those things to be sort of invariant to shifts. And we've used kind of this sort of sparse feature learning method that I talked about earlier to learn to recognize objects. So this is kind of a similar system that I talked about, that I showed, that I demonstrated, but it's trained unsupervised now for most of the layers. And so this is trained on the so-called Caltech 101 dataset, which has something like 101 categories. The images are sort of high-pass filtered versions of black and white images, 140 by 140 pixels. And we train those in this kind of sparse, overcomplete representation encoder-decoder architecture to extract features, and we stack multiple layers of this And we use those as the filters of a conventional net. And these are the filters we obtain at the various levels. And we get the performance level we get is something like 54% correct on the Caltech 101 using 30 samples per class. This was a year ago. If we use purely supervised backprop, so no unsupervised pre-training, we only get 20%, which is really bad. Okay. So the record on this data set at the time we did the paper was on the order of 60%, 65% or so. And now the record has been broken. There are sort of preprint that got something like 76% or so. So this is sort of falling behind, but it was sort of competitive about a year and a half ago. Does a really good job on sort of simple things to recognize, like dollar bills that don't, well, it's kind of a weird dollar bill. It's got George Bush. Things that don't have a background. And it does really bad on objects that are in the business of hiding themselves, like spotted cats. And that's pretty much all I wanted to say. So thank you very much.